Welcome to the Hoban Minute, a podcast that will shift your perspective on the business, politics, and culture of the hemp and marijuana industries. I'm your host, Xavier Jaye. It's 420 somewhere, so let's dive in. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Hoban Minute. This is Xavier, and I'm joined today, as I usually am, by Bob. How are you today, Bob?
I'm reeling. I'm reeling because I've always wanted to believe in aliens and UFOs, and the government has affirmed these facts as true. So I don't know what to do with myself these days.
Yeah, they've affirmed it as true, and I think we're all so fatigued from, I don't know what, COVID, that it really didn't make much of a splash. People were like, yeah, there's aliens. We know.
Next thing you know, they're going to find like Bigfoot's body, and people are going to be like, ah.
It is what it is.
Yeah, we thought it would look like that.
Right. Well, today we are joined by two very special guests, two longtime industry professionals that were initially on the enforcement side of the industry and then moved into consulting to help support licensed operators in the cannabis space, and then are now moving into doing some psychedelic consulting as well. And that is Kim Stuck, the founder and CEO of Allay Consulting, and Kelsey Hanley, senior project manager at Allay Consulting. How are you guys both doing today?
Doing good. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, great. Yeah, thanks again for having us.
No, of course. It's a pleasure to have you on. And I think I'll, start the episode here with telling a quick story of how we met. As listeners of the podcast know, I do come from the license side of the industry, the extraction space specifically. And I was managing a lab in, I think it was 2014 in Denver, Colorado, that unfortunately went through a bit of a recall. And lo and behold, the two enforcement officials that walked in to help me do the recall and oversee the destruction of the materials were Kim and Kelsey of the CDPHE. And so it's been interesting kind of watching both of our, all of our, I should say, career paths from that date progress forward, going from kind of working in your case on, again, the enforcement side of the industry into actually consulting licensed operators and how to avoid visits from public health departments. And then, myself going from the license side of the industry into kind of, advising and consulting, in a legal and regulatory aspect. So it's pretty interesting seeing that and having you guys, kind of develop your industry or your careers from the Colorado industry. And then now, Kim, as I understand it, you are in Oregon. Kelsey, I don't know where you're physically located, but I know you guys are both advising, clients all around the United States and even the world. So, congratulations on that success.
Thank you.
Yeah, you too, Xavier.
Well, I think it was that moment is something that led me to initially consider, hey, maybe, getting into the compliance and kind of regulatory side of things could be interesting, and it could be a way to actually effectuate some change, because I'll be the first to admit that I had kind of reached the end of my rope at that point with the license side of the industry and working for the business owners and operators at the time that were the pioneers in the space, because they were not the best managers or employers, unfortunately. But let's move beyond kind of the early days of the industry and jump into, what you guys have going on currently. Kim, I want to give you an opportunity to kind of describe to our listeners, Allay Consulting, what the business is, the services that you offer to the industry, and what led you to forming the company.
Me and Kelsey have been in the industry, like you said, as regulators back like 2014 when it became adult use regulated in Colorado, and we worked for Denver, the Denver Health Department, DDPHE, and it was a little crazy. I was there for a little over 3 years as their, cannabis specialist, and Kelsey was part of the cannabis team as well, obviously. I kind of fell in love with the industry, right? I mean, I met people like you, and I met, so many amazing operators and so many amazing companies that were making a really big difference, and just realized that, there weren't a lot of consultants that were helping with quality assurance and food safety and worker safety at that time. People were really struggling to understand the regulations and know what they can and can't do, and writing, good SOPs and training staff and that kind of thing. So I kind of took a leap of faith in 2017 and jumped off the edge and And then, you know, slowly just started hiring my friends so that we could, you know, live our best life. And, you know, it's been really great. I mean, we love the industry. We really believe in the plant medicine. And we really think that, you know, the industry, you know, is doing better and better every day. And we're glad to be a part of that and helping that process and that journey for the industry. So, yeah, I mean, it was kind of crazy. And we've just been really busy and all over. We work in, like you said, in all 50 states. We even have some international clients sometimes. And it's just been a real wild ride since 2017. I mean, we've been in business for 6 years now, which it feels like yesterday, but it's amazing.
So Kim, I want to talk a little bit more granular about how you service the industry and what the industry sort of looks like. But also, true or false, you left the employee of the government to get rid of a nickname that was bestowed upon you. Is that true?
Yeah, and people like you won't let me outlive it.
Well, for the benefit of our listeners, just because it truly is a cool name, what did certain people in the industry refer to you as when you were on the government enforcement side?
Yeah, so sometimes I walk into a party and I still get called the weed whacker of Denver. And, you know, back then I took it really hard when I heard that nickname because, I felt really bad about it because I did destroy a lot of products, right? There was a lot of unsafe practices that were happening and there was a lot of things that as regulators, we didn't know were going on, much of it pesticide related. And so, you know, I had to dispose of millions of dollars worth of products throughout my career and it was just really sad. And I did feel really bad about it, but at the same time, you know, the cannabis industry, you know, people who are consuming cannabis, I want them to consume things that are safe, right? So I was doing my job, but now, you know, I feel like the industry is getting better and better. And, you know, we still have to help facilitate recalls with our clients and things like that because things do happen, but I'm hoping that that'll be less and less in the future.
When Kim says dispose of, if I do recall, we have to coordinate getting in like large industrial wood chippers to take down certain batches that were implicated in the recalls.
Yeah. Wood chippers and bleach and dirt. And I mean, it was crazy back then, like absolute Wild West.
Well, I guess before I do get into this sort of a range of service offerings for the consultancy, I'm curious. When you work for the government and you're put in this position of enforcement, and as you point out, these are not things to just shrug off. I mean, without enforcement, these products would be out there in the marketplace having health effects and otherwise. And I think we've come a long, long way, truly thanks to forward-thinking governments that have adopted programs and put measures in place. But how do you settle on destroying a cannabis crop or cannabis product? Because, you know, it conjures up this video that maybe we've all seen one time or another where there's some journalist standing in a field and behind that journalist is this massive pile of cannabis just burning. And as the journalist is reporting this, he continues to get higher and higher just from the fumes. But believe it or not, my father's actually off and on an agent for the government that destroys pills and things like that. And they truly do burn those things. But tell me a little bit about the process or how the city of Denver came up with its protocols for rendering useless or destroying, however you want to describe it, cannabis crops that otherwise, you know, didn't pass muster.
Yeah. So we don't burn it for that exact reason. That's definitely a good way to just get really high all day, which, you know, I get back then I probably wouldn't have minded because it was a very stressful job. We would follow MED protocol, Marijuana Enforcement Division in Colorado, and we would render things, you know, unusable and unrecognizable. So we would usually grind, you know, if it was a plant matter, we would grind it or wood chip it and then mix it with soil or kitty litter or whatever. If it's vape pens and you know, those kinds of products, gummies, we would, you know, pour bleach on them and then mix them just to like denature the proteins and everything in it. It just kind of depended on what we could do at the time, you know, as long as it was not, you know, no one could go and pull it back out of the dumpster and sell it to the public or use it, then it was probably safe. So that's kind of what we followed with just the MED guidelines for destroying cannabis.
I think I got the bleach treatment.
The bleach treatment.
You did. Yeah. There's all concentrates. So was. Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting thing, though. It's and something to think about, because, you know, when you come around for a new responsibility for a government, even if in the absence of guidelines or even with guidelines, you always have to question, is this the right way to dispose of these materials? But let's talk just a little bit about the breadth of the services that the consultancy offers. When I talk about the cannabis industry, I talk about it as broadly as possible. I don't mean cannabis as marijuana, as it's sort of been, you know, transmogrified over the last several years. Cannabis is the plant, and things that flow from the plant, whether that's hemp or whether that's marijuana or whether that's cannabinoids, these are all distinct industries. And you know, I believe one of the first things that opened my mind, and Kim, you and I were on a rooftop, if I recall correctly, in maybe the fall of 2021 in Nashville, Tennessee. And my eyes were opened to how free that cannabis marketplace was in the absence of a commercial adult use marketplace. It was far freer than any market I had ever been in. And we're seeing that play out today. That was really my first sort of exposure to, wait a second. These governments are actually allowing Delta 8, Delta 9, Delta 10 from hemp to be put into the marketplace. And you know, that opened my eyes. But talk a little bit about your perception of what the cannabis industry means and how you service these distinct sectors.
Yeah, I mean, we believe the same as you. Cannabis is all of it, right? It encompasses everything from, you know, CBD to the derivative cannabinoids that are intoxicating or non-intoxicating. It's the plant, right? And so when I speak of cannabis, I'm talking about all hemp products, all marijuana products, and, you know, kind of everything in between, right? And, you know, as far as we're concerned, as long as we have a lot of clients that do a lot of different things. And when it comes to like Delta 8, I'm just going to use that as an example because it's one of the biggest sold things. If it's in a state that it's allowed, right, and it's legal and it's, so, you know, the state is okay with it, then we don't really see why that company couldn't do things and put compliances in place to make sure that those products are safe, right? And we really focus on, you know, food safety, worker safety, and quality assurance. And so if we have a company that reaches out to us and they're like, hey, we make Delta 8 and HHC and, you know, THCO and all of these products in this state, and that state is, you know, you're allowed to do it, we think, okay, we're going to help these guys get, you know, GMP certification and be compliant with FDA standards and all of that fun stuff. Because our goal as a company is to make the cannabis industry safer for consumers, right? And safer for workers. So we do work with those companies. And I believe personally that there's a place for all of those derivative cannabinoids. It just has to be legal and regulated, right? And that's really all that I think matters.
Yeah, and I think Olay, you know, and the two of you are providing, you know, an important service by giving almost that roadmap to legitimization for some of these operators and some of these industries, right? Hey, this is how you act as a good company. This is how you, you know, ensure that employee safety is top of mind. This is how you ensure that you're complying with standard food safety regulations. Because at the end of the day, you know, I think a lot of these companies don't realize that they have the same operational requirements that any other traditional business might have. And you know, they're not really kind of keeping that top of mind, and they're really just pursuing revenue, right? And then the dollar. And I don't think they're necessarily focused on longevity of the company. And so, you know, Kelsey, this might be a question more for you, just kind of insights from the field. But with that in mind, with kind of, you know, how you guys are helping legitimize the industry, not just from your client's perspective, but, you know, at large, what are some of the, you know, top compliance mistakes that we're seeing from that kind of employee safety, food safety perspective that, you know, time and time again, you're seeing out there in the field that, you know, cannabis operators could quickly and easily address to make their businesses, you know, operate more efficiently and safer?
Yeah, great question. So I'll start on the federal side for the OSHA oversight. So that oversight is a bit confusing for marijuana licensees because OSHA is a federal program, right? And marijuana isn't federally legalized just yet. So a lot of licensees believe because marijuana isn't legalized just yet federally, that OSHA doesn't have oversight. Gotcha. Well, that is beyond wrong. Right. So
it's like the shock when talk about 280E. And they're like, what do you mean the IRS is collecting taxes? It's like, yep.
Exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, although OSHA might not have, you know, marijuana licenses on their like regular inspection list, if they get a complaint from that business, they have a right to show up that same day or next day or, you know, whenever they can schedule that in. So it does catch businesses off guard for sure. And we have had a lot of companies use our services after getting that knock at the door. So a lot of those complaints end up being legitimate. And I mean, a lot of those are just, you know, low hanging fruit. I mean, a lot of them are just missing certain SOPs. So for example, like when you guys go to a hotel, at the back of the door, you'll see an emergency evacuation route. That is a legal thing that that company has to have. So every business has to have that. I mean, that's pretty simple, you know, to put together an emergency action plan. And These requirements aren't just unique to the cannabis industry. You know, this is widely required for all businesses. So another one would be a hazardous communication plan. So if you have chemicals inside your establishment, you have to train your employees what they are and what they're exposed to.
We've mm-hmm. unfortunately seen, you know, kind of a rise lately in occupational, you know, injuries and deaths in the cannabis space. And, you know, I kind of, this might just be me thinking out loud. But, you know, I do wonder who it falls on, right? When the federal regulators are not specifically addressing issues in like a particular industry or industry segment, and then there's not any oversight from any other, you know, state authorities. So it falls really on the operators then to establish kind of best practices. And, you know, I just kind of, I wonder who is going to lead the charge there? And if it's going to be, I mean, I assume, I guess it would be just the good actors in the industry, because I don't expect the regulators to do anything anytime soon specific to, you know, occupational safety in cannabis.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we don't see a lot of like education that comes from, you know, federal government. But I mean, the same goes for the FDA and, you know, right. EPA, stuff like that. So yeah, I mean, to your point, Xavier, like, there has to be, you know, internal expectations, you know, for the industry. And so a lot of that starts with education. So a lot of companies just don't know what they don't know. So what we've seen is that whenever these companies get that knock at the door from OSHA, they are completely blindsided, never even knew that that was an expectation. So I think, you know, spreading the word is a start.
Yeah.
To changing that.
Right. That, hey, you know, whether or not you're ultimately beholden or you think you're beholden or not, you better, you know, start acting good because you're representing the rest of the industry, essentially.
Yep. Yep. Exactly. Because whenever we go into work, you know, we want to leave the exact same way we, you know, started work. You know, we don't want to leave work, you know, hurt or, you know, or anything like that that could have been prevented.
Yeah. I we've seen a lot of these different OSHA-related issues pop up over the years, but you know, unfortunately, from several of my clients over the years, the responses I got were always unsettling. It was, well, these people are choosing to work in a cannabis facility or a cultivation facility or a processing facility, and you know, let alone the safety as it relates to what's in the air, but also you know, the solvents that are used in a processing or a manufacturing facility and just the machinery in and of itself. So these are things that should always be top of mind. But for some reason, the cannabis industry always has a difficult time understanding the nuance of what's important. And I mean that sincerely. I mean, I'm a big believer in the economic downturn we see in the industry is because the cannabis industry, the marijuana sector in particular, really just doesn't connect with its consumers. And when you think about the, you know, the loyalty and the conditions that you must put in place as an employer for employees, that sort of always seems to get swept aside as well, even though it's one of the most critical things. You can't have a business without employees, and you have an obligation to your employees to make sure, as you point out, that you leave that day the same way you walked in the morning. And but it's sort of generalized towards this mindset of compliance, whether it's OSHA, whether it's regulations over packaging, whatever the law or requirement might be. I always get the feeling that business owners in this space treat compliance like, oh my gosh, I wish this didn't exist. It's a pain in my backside to have to deal with this stuff. But isn't it more properly viewed as an asset if done right? Because doesn't it increase the value of your business and probably just make your business more better run, is what I was going to say. But you understand what
certainly
I mean.
Certainly mo better.
Mo better for everyone. I mean, it truly makes the business more efficient. And I mean, when you set those compliance expectations right from the start, things move more fluidly within the company, whether it's compliance related or accounting or whatever. You know, it's almost like the departments communicate better together.
And the modern consumer cares about all this stuff, right? They look into management practices. They look into, you know, what the company is doing from a community development perspective. And at the end of the day, if they're faced with two identical gummies, but one's having a great community outreach program, you know, most of the time, I think the consumer will pick the one with a good community outreach program. And I think the same applies for, you know, compliance and kind of weaponizing compliance as an asset and going out and saying affirmatively, yes, we are, you know, complying with all regulations, and we're actually going above and beyond what's required of us to ensure that our employees are safe and that our products are, you know, safe for consumers.
It's all about risk mitigation, really. I mean, and that's really what we specialize in, is, you know, cutting down on the chances of something terrible happening and ruining your brand identity, like a recall or disposal or any of that. And then also, you know, cutting down on worker safety incidents. Obviously, there's a lot of money wasted and things like that. And then on top of that, it really, you know, showing that you can do these kinds of compliances and get these certifications like GMP and ISO and GACP, you know, it makes your company shine. And yeah, investors love that. Like, that is one of the number one ways to get investors and licenses, is to have those kinds of certifications and be ready to dedicate yourself to that standard.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, something I want to kind of put out there is that I think we all have this massive responsibility that, you know, some of us veterans sometimes, I don't know if we forget about it, but we don't keep it top of mind that, you know, at the end of the day, this industry is very new, still extremely controversial. And we all have to make sure that, you know, the folks that are licensed and approved to do whatever sort of business within the space are doing so in a good way, and demonstrating to the, you know, the haters out there, if you will, that cannabis is a legitimate industry, and, you know, there are ways to operate above board, and it's not just a bunch of, you know, criminals essentially that are cannabinoid cowboys out there slanging drugs to kids. So I think compliance is a great way to demonstrate that to the world. And so, you know, I think One question I want to ask you guys is really how you see, with that in mind, right, with us kind of talking about the legitimacy of the industry and helping the industry move along, what's your role outside of, you know, directly advising your clients on how to be compliant, how to, you know, comply with the regulations, on how you guys in LA Consulting maybe generally are helping move the needle for the industry outside of those specific services?
Do you want me to take this one, Kelsey? So we do a lot of things. Mainly we volunteer a lot of our time. There's a lot of things in LA that we do that we don't get paid for, such as being on regulatory work groups. Kelsey's on several, all in a couple different states. I am actually the vice chair of the GMP subcommittee for D37 at ASTM as well, which is a standard company that does everything from aerospace to concrete, you know, and they're developing standards, and I volunteer a lot of time doing that, and that writing those standards and helping governments figure out how regulations should work and how to make safe products and how to test and how, you know, navigate those waters is really important to us, because we really, truly believe in the industry and we really, really want them to succeed, obviously. So definitely that's kind of the way that we use our, you know, past experiences and our knowledge and wisdom about the industry and the things we've seen to help newer states come online and help states, you know, revamp their regulations and those kinds of things. We also, you know, believe in the plant medicine. And so, you know, I just recently went through a cancer diagnosis and survived, which is amazing. And a lot of it was because of cannabis and mushroom therapies. So nowadays, I kind of shout from the rooftop that whole journey as well. So I think that, you know, when you find an industry that you love and you find and you have the passion for it, I mean, no matter what, we're going to gravitate to moving that needle and pushing it. Even though, you know, we're here, it's a job, we make money, we like to, you know, help our clients and all of that. But I think that the cool thing about LA is that everyone that's involved in my company is a true believer in the medicine, and we want the industry and we want access and we want normalization as well, which is like, you know, we're always pushing for that as much as we can.
Well, you know, Kim, and you know, you are a fighter, as you mentioned, and you talked a little bit about some of the therapies. Let's talk about psychedelics for a moment. That regulatory structure that was enacted by statute is coming to fruition here. I believe we'll see some rules come out towards the end of this year and applications for this new dispensation model coming out in January or so. But it's
just to be clear,
yes,
Colorado and Oregon.
Correct. But I'm specifically talking about the Colorado and those timelines.
Understood.
But thank you for that, Xavier. The issue is, the model is slightly different than the cannabis distribution model. You're not necessarily setting up a place where you just walk in and buy products, although that's what it might ultimately become. It's really meant to tie hand-in-hand treatment and sort of oversight of the use of these natural medicines with the sale thereof. And that presents some of its own compliance challenges, particularly because it becomes more and more like a healthcare type model, which of course is strictly regulated. Do you guys work in the psychedelic space and or do you have a perspective on the upside, the future of this? Not necessarily from a therapeutic perspective, because I think we can all agree on this call that the science supports the therapeutic benefits for a number of reasons, although please feel free to talk about that if that's of interest to you, particularly in the journey you've just been on, Kim. But at the end of the day, is the business model going to be sustainable? I read about these clinics that are opening in different states where they're charging $3,000 per treatment. I'm sorry, but your average person absolutely cannot afford anything close to that, particularly on a recurring basis. So what is it about this model that attracts so much attention, and does it have legs?
Kelsey, do you want to speak about, or do you have an opinion on that?
If you want to speak to the financial side of it, because you brought up some good points a few weeks ago when you and I were talking about that. But So specific to Oregon. So yeah, Oregon's license environment is a little bit odd. So yeah, you can't just like go to a dispensary and buy psychedelic mushrooms just yet. I mean, who knows what the future holds there. But I mean, there's a lot of hands that have to touch that product before the end consumer can actually get it. And so because you can't just walk into a storefront or a dispensary type facility to get it, you have to like sit down with a licensed person for them to sit with you and experience the mushroom together. So, you know, I don't know about you guys, but that's not how I want to experience mushrooms. So I think you're going to shy away some, you know, consumers there. It's definitely a different setup than what we currently have in like the marijuana industry, where you can just go in and yeah, there's limits to how much you can buy, but you're pretty free on how much, or I guess what different products, you know, you can purchase. there. So Oregon has some different requirements there. I would be interested to see how Colorado has their future set up as far as like a storefront setup or not.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. I would want to have like a, I don't know, two or three sessions just to get to know my therapist, my trip guide or whatever you want to call them before I'm just, you know, sitting there tripping on mushrooms and talking to a stranger about, you know, my deepest, darkest secrets.
Exactly. I mean, you're in a very like vulnerable situation. So, I mean, they're called facilitators. So, I mean, they have to go through intense training, but still, I mean, to your point, Xavier, like you want to be able to trust that person when you're extremely vulnerable.
Yeah. And it's also really interesting. Like you make an appointment and it includes, I think, two different appointments. So the first appointment that you go into, you do get to know the person and you don't take anything.
Oh, okay.
And it's an evaluation, like, it, you know, telling you about what you're going to experience, like getting you ready for it, if you will. And then you go in and then there's two therapists there to make sure that you're not being taken advantage of while in this vulnerable space. So when we talk about the price, right, Bob, you're talking about who can afford $3,000. You're talking about the overhead for the building. You're talking about keeping the lights on. You're talking about paying two full-time, you know, therapists to sit in a room with someone for potentially 6 hours, you know, or longer. If I paid like my normal therapist, I mean, it would be extravagant for that long of a time. And so that's kind of what they're running into is, because of the way the regulations are written and because they're, you know, worried about people being taken advantage of, which I totally understand. But, you know, they have to have a camera, you know, everywhere, cameras everywhere and security and all that, you know, all the things that all cost money to have, that's what's making this price so astronomical. And then on top of that, you know, that price doesn't include the actual mushroom that you're buying from the little store downstairs that you're taking up into a room to you know, experience this trip. And so it's really interesting the way that they kind of put it all together and how the regulations work. And I, the first thing that I said, because I was part of some of the work groups early on when these regulations started being put together, and that was one of my biggest concerns. I'm like, how in the world is someone going to be able to afford this? Like how are we going to stay in business with, you know, if we have to pay all of these people to be there all the time, you know, and all of that. So, you know, I think that the price is definitely a huge issue, but at the same time, you know, how do you keep the price down when you have to have so many people involved and trained and all of that too? Just something to keep in mind. I don't know.
No, and it is interesting also for us from the cannabis perspective, because we look at, you know, access to cannabis and it's like, okay, overtaxed, overregulated, and illicit markets across the country are still thriving, right? And so it makes you wonder, okay, when you apply that kind of same model or approach to psychedelics, how many folks is this going to actually help if, again, the administrative costs are so prohibitive that, you know, only the top percent of the population can actually afford it? So hopefully access to psychedelics.
Well, and that's the problem is the population, many populations that, you know, need this therapy the most are people who, you know, don't have a lot of money, you know, they're veterans and, you know, people who have been injured and people who have been through, you know, traumatic stuff, or, you know, people who are addicted to other drugs. You know, those are the people that really need this therapy and that would benefit from it. And it's almost like we're ignoring that completely. I kind of wish if I had, you know, an endless amount of time, which, you know, obviously I'm very busy, but I would start a nonprofit to, you know, try to help fund people who are really in need, like veterans in particular, to try to pay for their therapy. I think that would be amazing. And I'm hoping that somebody does that at some point. And if they don't, I'll probably end up doing it eventually. But, you know, because it's just $3,500 to do one, you know, 8 hour, you know, 6 to 8 hour session. You know, I don't know anybody that can afford that, you know, except for, you know, the top 10% of, you know, the wealthiest people.
So ultimately, though, this policy progress, the drug reform, if you will, or an awakening about using natural compounds for therapeutic benefits, all of that progress is terrific. But when you balance the business case versus the sort of, you know, public policy case, they're not necessarily congruent right now. And this is one of the things that leads me to just question, why is there so much fervor and excitement around the psychedelics industry? I get what I mentioned a minute ago. Yes, these are being recognized on a wider stage, so forth and so on. Although I just read an article, somebody was bashing Aaron Rodgers because of his speech here at MAPS, the psychedelic conference in Denver, a month or so ago. Almost making fun of it as if what people aren't really talking about these things, but the answer is yes, they are. So that's progress. But when you have a policy that doesn't jive with a business model, I just fear without, you know, nonprofits or people stepping up, as you suggested, the human case, that these business owners and these investors are going to be led astray because the population, at least presently, of people percentage wise that will use these compounds, it's not as great as the marijuana industry and in terms of numbers. And we see what's happening in the overtaxed, overregulated marijuana system. So my advice is to proceed with caution on the business side, but if you do it correctly, make sure you're in compliance. But also, we need to look for other solutions than to just create these overtaxed, overregulated structures, which are well-meaning and it represents progress, but it doesn't necessarily represent anything viable on a business side.
Yeah, I actually was just in Austin speaking at South by Southwest, and the whole panel was about the parallels and differences between the cannabis industry and psilocybin. And the problem that I find is people just reach out to us, right, on our website about everything. Oh, we're thinking about getting into the psychedelics. Yeah, we're in cannabis. And I have to be very real with people. You know, cannabis and psychedelics are very, very different. They're going to be very, very different types of business models. It's not going to be a green rush or, you know, mushroom rush or whatever, the same way that cannabis was. And, you know, the reasoning behind that is you're right. There's a lot less people that are using psychedelics. With cannabis, there are daily smokers, right? And there are definitely people that'll, microdose psilocybin, 4 days a week or whatever. But that's such a small amount, you're not going to be selling the same weight as you would in cannabis, right? And many times, someone will do like a really in-depth, trip once a year just to get, their brain back in the way that they want it to be and, all of that. But it's once a year, and that's how powerful that medicine is. It's very different than the daily use that people, have with cannabis. And so, the margins are different. You have to build your business around it really different. It is going to be very difficult. I think that people can do it, and you're exactly right. As long as they're compliant, that's the other thing. Is every set of law or regulation that's come out really, really in the psychedelic industry is really talking about health and safety and quality assurance. They're very focused on that. Whereas in the cannabis industry, that wasn't even mentioned, until, 2014 in most cases. It was crazy. I mean, so it's definitely something that's on the forefront. And, you just have to go into it knowing that it's not going to be the same as cannabis. And if you have that mindset and you know that it's something different, I still think you can have a really great business. It's just going to be very different. And if you think it's going to be the same as cannabis, I'm scared that that would cause failure, because it's going to be very different.
It will. And that's, that's some good advice right there, and kind of some important tough love that you have to give to your clients sometimes when they come in with an expectation or idea, and it's your job to kind of set them on the right path. And I'm honestly just excited to see kind of what sort of products and research and development comes out of, more research and access to psychedelic medicines, because maybe there is, a daily application that, we just don't know about yet. But we'll see in the coming years as more and more jurisdictions start to approve and allow these medicines to be used, we'll start getting that feedback and that research and that data from the public. So Definitely going to be keeping a track on that, and especially as the data starts to come out of Oregon and Colorado and these initial pilot programs. You know, I think we've covered an extensive amount of topics today, guys. I think we've done everything from, you know, your inception in the cannabis space through now obviously talking about psychedelics and what's next for that industry. You know, I think it's a good opportunity for us to wind down here, but I, of course, want to give you both an opportunity to shout out, you know, any relevant projects you might be working on, and, of course, let our listeners know how and where they can contact you.
Yeah, so I have to give a shout out about Olaypalooza, which is going to be, that's like our company party / ancillary trade show that we have in Denver every year. It's on September 22nd. And thank you guys for being some of our sponsors there. It's going to be a really great time. It's coming up. I'm very excited. I will be in Denver in person this year, which is going to be great. And you guys can, you know, anybody can reach out to our website and check us out. We're at www.allayconsulting.com. And then you can always email us directly at kelsey.hanley@allayconsulting.com or kim.stuck@allayconsulting.com. So we are happy to answer any questions that anyone has, and definitely check out our website. And yeah, hopefully we can connect.
Well, it was a pleasure having you guys on, and we're looking forward to having you guys on again in the future. Maybe we'll talk about the state of the psychedelics industry in a few years after it's developed a little bit. So let's bookmark that for now. And again, thank you both for coming on, and hope you guys have a great rest of the evening here.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us for another enlightening conversation. If you liked what you heard, hit that subscribe button to get all future episodes fresh out of the studio. Suggestions for topics or guests for the show, please send them to hello@bobhoban.com. And as always, thanks to Benzinga for powering the Hoban Minute.